All right, welcome to class. Before we dive in, are there comments, questions, concerns, or other things for me? Okay. Today we're going to talk about liquids. Won't that be so much fun? We'll talk some more about liquids on Tuesday. Let's start by looking at the Navier-Stokes equation. Okay. Navier-Stokes equation has various formulations, depending on exactly how you want to look at it. So let's see if we can find the usual one. Okay, so you'll see there's all these. Here's the Navier-Stokes momentum equation and the linear stress corrective equation in there anyway. And they have lots of nobles in them. And if you know what all of this means, they're really important. Okay, these are the equations that specify the behavior of liquids. And we're going to talk about the pieces of the equations, and we're going to basically ignore the math. We're going to talk about the practical math. And we'll occasionally hand wave it, but there's some basic ideas. Okay, the first thing we have is incompressible. Incompressible is a characteristic of liquids. It's not a characteristic of gases, but in practice it usually acts like a characteristic of gases. So gases are technically compressible, but practically very close to incompressible for visual effects. And so we'll often use incompressible for all kinds of fluids. An incompressible fluid means if you squeeze it somewhere, it might bubble up somewhere else. You can have hydraulic systems and so on. And if you can have a hydraulic system, it means you can't do any kind of local simulation, right? If I wanted to have some long pipe and I want to simulate, right, you put extra weight on one side and so the water bubbles out the other side, there is no general system that I can make that will solve only the local region and have that pop up. So all simulations of water, by nature of being incompressible, have to have some sort of look at the whole thing simulation approach. And in computing, we basically know how to do one of those, solving linear systems of equations. And really, we know how to do sparse linear systems of equations. So almost always, we're going to find some way of turning the real math into a sparse system of linear equations and then solving it using some version of conjugate gradient. And we'll talk about a couple of different ways of getting there. At least we'll talk at one of them in some detail, the other one at a fairly hand-wavy level. Okay? When we think about incompressible, we often think about this in the idea of divergence-free velocity field. Okay, so what do I mean by a divergence-free velocity field? Let's start by what I mean by a velocity field. Imagine we divide the world into squares, because we like squares. Okay, and I want to know how water is flowing. And so I could just say, I'm going to figure out how the water is flowing inside of each cell. And if it's hardly moving at all, I'll make a little arrow. And if it's moving really fast, I'll make a big arrow. I can just put an arrow in each cell. This is a vector field. Okay? If we have them defined for every point in space, then I have myself a vector field. Okay? A divergence-free vector field means that the thing that's flowing into and out of any given space is equal. And by any given space, mathematically, if it's really defined everywhere, not just on the grid, I mean, you can draw any closed shape you want, and the integral of all vectors coming in and all vectors going out is zero. Okay? And so this is a characteristic of incompressible fluids. Whatever goes into any region, whether it's a square, whether it's some arbitrary thing, whatever goes in comes out. Otherwise, you would have divergence. You'd have positive divergence if it's more is flowing out than in. You'd have negative divergence if more is flowing in than out. That's not really important because we always get rid of divergence. Okay? And so very often, one of the steps we're going to do in dealing with liquids is we're going to get an approximate velocity field, and then we're going to fix it to make it divergence-free, because liquids are divergence-free. So this is one of the characteristics of fluids. They're incompressible. They're divergence-free. And if we think a little bit about divergence-free, there's various patterns we'll tend to notice. Okay? For example, Whirlpools and all other types of vortices are divergence-free, right? Vortices, the plural of vortex, okay? And so anything, any velocity field we can make out of the sum of a bunch of vortices is going to be divergence-free. And it turns out that in the giant world of I can re-express everything's in other terms, you can express any divergence-free velocity field as the sum of a set of vortexes. And there are solutions of fluids that use vorticity as the primary thing we deal with. They're a little less common. We're not going to spend a whole lot of time on them today. But vorticity is something that matters, okay? And then, of course, we can have other sorts of things, right? But in general, if I say a fluid is flowing in to some spot from two sides, it has to flow out, right? And so that means I have to be flowing out at least in one of the two sides, okay? Right? So whatever flows in, flows out, you pick any point, you can figure out what's going on and see what's happening. One of the phenomena this creates, if we imagine here is fluid, let's suppose the bottom of the fluid I put red dye in, and then I heat it up. Hotter fluids rise. The reason they do this is actually because they gain volume, but that's a side note, okay? Hotter fluids rise. So this fluid here wants to go up. For that fluid to go up, the fluid that was above it has to go down or somewhere else, right? So this fluid wants to start rising. But for that fluid to rise, the total volume of red fluid can't change. So this fluid here starts going everywhere else, and so you'll end up with a little bit of a dip. And over time, you will end up with mushrooms. Okay? And we'll talk more about why this is the actual shape you get. Okay? As this fluid goes up, it needs to push this fluid away, and some of that comes in on the side, and that is the origin of mushroom clouds. Mushroom clouds are caused by some amount of fluid suddenly wants to go up. And there is a ground. You need to ground too. If you don't have ground, you get a slightly different shape, but similar kinds of ideas. So there's various visual phenomena that are characteristic of different aspects of incompressible fluids, combined with a handful of other little phenomena we'll talk about in a moment, of which mushroom clouds are one of the most visually noticeable that exist. All right, incompressible. The other main piece we have to understand about fluids is they are self-advecting. In order to understand self-advecting, we probably need to start by talking about advecting, because I doubt most of you know what it means to advect. So, imagine for a moment, I had inside each one of these cells a sort of omnidirectional conveyor belt. Okay? And so I could say this conveyor belt is rolling that way, and this conveyor belt is rolling that way, and that one's rolling over there, and that one's rolling down there. And then I would just drop a block on this. It will move around, right? I drop something on it, it'll land on this block, it'll slide down here, oh, it'll slide over here, and it'll go over there, and we could follow the path that some object might go across this. Okay? This is the process if we don't have a finite grid of conveyor belts, but a vector field of conveyor belts. This process of following the vector field is advection. Okay? Advection is what makes fluids look like something, right? What causes smoke to move? It advects through the air around it. Okay, so advection matters. The odd thing about liquids that makes their computation hard is the velocity field advects itself. Okay, what does that mean? That means that if at one point I have a bunch of velocity field here going over there and in front of that and behind it the liquid was stationary, this moving liquid is going to move. And so at a future time, I would expect this velocity field to have sort of moved along itself, okay? And so it'll have pushed itself along. This is really just another way of saying momentum, right? Newton understood this principle. Liquids have mass. They move themselves, okay? And because they move themselves, we get flow. We get patterns in what is happening, So we have this self-advecting characteristic combined with a divergence-free characteristic, and this governs most of what we want to think about for liquids. There is a handful of other things that Navier-Stokes also has to deal with, like sort of essentially the fluid drags against itself. So we'll talk a little bit about those aspects a little bit later. But let's start with just self-advecting and divergence-free or incompressible and see if we can make a fluid simulation have these properties. Before you start diving into math, questions about the principal properties we're trying to obtain? Okay. We're going to start with a finite difference method. A Lagrangian approach. We're going to have the fluid going through cells. And there's different ways we could represent the cells. We're going to use something called the staggered grid. By the staggered grid, I mean that we are going to store the y aspect of flux on the boundaries between cells, okay? And we're going to store the x on the boundary between x cells, and we would store whatever is moving around through the fluids inside the cells themselves. Okay, so we have different things stored at different places in the grid. Our x coordinates are on the centers of the boundaries between cells in x. That's where we're going to have our x. Okay, we're going to have our y on the centers of the boundaries between cells in y. That's where we're going to have the y component of fluid motion. And then our stuff is just going to be centered in the cells. So if we want to know what color it is or what heat it is or whatever it is we're moving around, that is going to be inside the cells or how much fluid there is, etc. Okay, this is the staggered grid approach. And what we're going to do is we're just going to derive formulas for both divergence-free, incompressible characteristic, and formulas for self-advection and see how we would combine them to make a fluid simulation. So let's start with divergence-free. Divergence-free turns out to just be a linear system of equations. For any given cell, so let's start, we're going to have to name all of these numbers. Okay, we're going to have to name the velocities. For divergence-free, the velocities are all we care about. So let's just arbitrarily call this y0, y1, y2, y3, and so on. Oh, let's just decide to write a whole lot more of them. y5, y6, y7, y8, y9. And so on. I'll stop writing those. And we'll also just name our x's. Let's call this x0 and x1 and x2 and x3, x4. I don't have enough of them. We'll call that x5. All right, so I'm going to number all of these things. Any given cell, the divergence-free property gives me a linear system of four variables. Right? So this cell right here, let's zoom in on this cell. This cell guarantees that I need to maintain the following property. Let's just decide that positive in x is to the right. I'm going to say the stuff flowing in minus the stuff flowing out plus the stuff flowing in minus the stuff flowing out, if we decide that y goes down and x goes to the right, needs to be zero. Okay, and I can make one of these constraints for every cell. And if one of these cells is up against a wall, I just leave out the term that would go through the wall. Because there's no flow there, so the other pieces have to be zero. And so for every cell, I can create one of these equations. And then if I combine them all, I end up with a linear system of equations. In general, each of these terms will appear in two equations. Each equation will have four terms. A handful of the equations will be smaller because we have boundaries or the like. But I can create this system of equations. Okay? And the system of equations, we always have zeros over here, right? So we can end up, oh, if we think about it in sort of the big picture, we're going to end up, maybe let's do this in another one, right? So we're going to end up with a whole bunch, a big matrix times all of our x0, x1, x2, and so on, y0, y1, y2, and so on, right? And each of these equations, the one we just did, was what? Positive in x1, negative in x2. So we have 0, x0, a positive x1, a negative x2, and then a bunch of zeros until we get over to the y's. And in the y's, we were using y1, that isn't y2, that should be y6, right? Because y6 is the one down there. Okay, so I had a positive y1 and a negative y6. So I have 0, y1, 0, y0, positive y1, I said, yes. A positive y1, y2, y3, y4, y5, y6, and then lots more zeros, right? And for each and every cell, I can make a row in this matrix. And then the divergence-free says this needs to give me zeros, because this is a measure of the divergence of the fluid, okay? And so it should be zero. And ta-da, I have a sparse linear system of equations, which we're good at solving. Hooray! Questions? Yes?
So can you explain again about each row in the matrix being not entirely sure with this matrix? What is the first row like, all the zeros?
The first row I have is the equation for this cell I have arbitrarily picked. Okay, so if we multiply this vector of variables by this row, we're going to get no x0s, a positive x1, a negative x2, a positive x1, a negative x2, etc. Right? So each row of the matrix is going to create one of those equations for one of the cells. So the number of rows I'm going to have is equal to the number of cells. The number of columns I'm going to have is going to be equal to the number of cell borders. And because I have this staggered grid, those won't be the same. This will not be a square matrix. Yes?
Would it not be possible for each of the x and y vectors to be like pointing into the cell? If they're all pointing in?
If they're all pointing in, I have divergence. I violated incompressibility.
Okay.
So we just decide, we pick a direction for all of the x's point to the right, all of the y's point down, or something like that. We technically don't have to make those decisions as long as we're consistent. If I just arbitrarily decided y6 points the opposite direction for its sign you'd expect, this and this equation will switch signs. We'll actually end up with the same result at the end. But we just arbitrarily pick. We decide positive x means moving to the right, and so every cell is going to have plus its left side minus its right side plus its top side minus its bottom side is the equation. Yeah?
What are we solving for?
We would be solving for a set of velocities that satisfies this equation. What is one set of velocities that you could just by inspection know will satisfy this equation? All zeros. Does a fluid that is not moving satisfy incompressibility?
Yes.
However, this is not a unique solution. There are many solutions to this equation. Okay? So this is an underdetermined system. We cannot invert this matrix. It doesn't have a direct inverse. So what we do instead is we use this pseudo-inverse property or various other tricks of squaring things to make them come out nicely. But in principle, what we do is we do some sort of iterative approach. So iterative approaches to solving linear systems, a topic well beyond what we'll talk about. But basically we say, given an initial guess of what our velocities are and the constraints, tweak it as little as you can several times in a row until this starts being true, okay? And basically what we do is we say, okay, you have some velocities, I multiply it, I don't get zeros, I figure out where I didn't get zeros, I adjust this to make it closer to zero, is the basic principle. There are other ways of writing this. So if we were to write this instead, sometimes what we'll do is we'll write this slightly differently, where we'll measure this product here is often considered to be proportional to the pressure term. Okay? It's not a perfect match for pressure, but the idea is if you get a positive number, it means you had more things trying to flow in. If you had a negative term, you had things trying to flow out. Pressure is going to fix that. So sometimes we'll multiply once to get a pressure, and we'll make a new version of this that's how much do we need to change the velocities to make it divergence-free using the pressure as part of that. And knowing what the pressure is can make you do cool things like weird quasi-fluids that change their physical properties when they're under high pressure or showing pressure in some ways. So sometimes doing this in several steps will work better. But in all of them, we end up with some sort of sparse matrix, some under-constrained system that we want to find something that minimizes how much we change to make it solve. And that will give us divergence-free. Questions? Yeah?
How do you solve for like which elements in that to like adjust?
Yeah, so this is not a course in numerical methods, but the basic answer is we use conjugate gradient. What does that really mean? So we trust mathematicians. I mean, we can find out what they mean, but let's just look a little bit. All right, so the conjugate gradient method, this isn't going to be a perfect match, but we'll talk about, I guess we can go through how we'll do this. All right, so the conjugate gradient method is this idea, it's a hill climbing method, okay? So the goal of this is to find, given some initial guess, you want to find the one that maximizes something. Okay, actually minimizes in this case, it's going to minimize what's called the residual magnitude. Minimizes how wrong we are, how much pressure we have in the system, how much divergence we have. Okay, and the conjugate gradient method has this property where we always go at right angles based on the current gradient of the function. Gradients of matrices are fairly easy to compute. The details of it along the way have all kinds of little tricks and so on, but if we go way down to the resulting algorithm, here it is, in code, this is what we do. Okay? This is it. We say, okay, I have the ax plus b is the thing, here's my initial guess, I multiply, I do the subtraction, that gives me my residual, this is how wrong I am. And then I do weird math, where this means dot product, a column vector transpose times a vector is a dot product. This is what we call an induced inner product. I think I may have the wrong word in front of it. But this is an inner product around the matrix A. That actually puts constraints on what the matrix can look like. So we sometimes precondition the matrix to make it look properly. We do this a bunch of times until it gets close enough, until the residual is low enough we don't care anymore. And then we say, ta-da, I'm done. Okay. And then we have this like, if it's sufficiently small, exit the loop. What does that mean, right? We decide. So there's variants of this, there's so many variants of this. But this basic approach works really well for a lot of sparse linear systems. What we will find though is we have this initial guess and we try to solve this. Now, if we try to do this exactly as we formulated this, it's not going to work really well. Because this needs a symmetric positive definite matrix. Who knows? I'm just curious. How many of you could define positive definite? Okay, 4 or 5. All right. There are a lot of things we can measure about matrices. This doesn't have any of the cool properties except being sparse. Sparse makes it efficient, but nothing else. Sparse meaning it's mostly zeros, okay? That makes it efficient to compute with, but we're not there yet, so we are going to like find ways of multiplying this equation by other things until it becomes a property that works nicely. And I could go through all of those steps, but I think it would be a tedious way of spending the day. If you decide you want to do fluid simulation for your final project, for example, come to my office and we'll talk about how to go through all these steps. Yes?
Pseudo-ish pseudocode that you showed had the significantly small. What if you made that to be a large number? What would your simulation look like?
You would have a lot of divergence.
So would it just crash, or what would it look like?
No. It'd be like, okay, if I have two gushes of water moving towards each other, they just overlap and cancel out. Yep. And your vortexes, instead of continuing to spin, they would all just sort of go in straight lines and just sort of whew, turn into like this big ripply kind of thing. Yeah. It wouldn't look like fluids. It wouldn't actually even look cool. I mean, have all kinds of things canceling each other out and so on. Yeah. It's fairly easy to try this if you want. As we're going to see, the self-advection is a much simpler thing to compute. So if you want to try creating a vector field and self-advecting, you can probably whip that up in the course of a couple of hours. All right. So we haven't talked about self-advection yet, but any other questions about this hand-wavy explanation of how we would go about if we tried making things divergence-free? Okay. Now let's talk about advection. All right. I have a vector field in every point in space. I have some vector, but in a computer, I can't represent every point in space very easily, so we tend to sample it on some sort of grid. Okay? And I want to know the basic step we're going to go. Here's we're going to go sort of one frame or one time step at a time. There are approaches that will actually simulate different parts of the fluid with different number of time steps, but they're kind of complicated to make work. So we're going to assume we just say, we want to go some amount of time in the future. And so we want to know if at time zero, something was there, right? So if this is at t equals zero, where will it be at t equals 10? And we just have to like know where to find it. So there's two basic approaches. First off, this is a problem of numerical integration that Runge-Kutta works beautifully for, if you know what that means. But we don't care. Runge-Kutta is more work than we need the accuracy. So we're always going to use one of the simplest kinds of numerical integration there is. We're going to use either forward or backward advection. Let's start with forward advection. Forward advection works very simply. I take this point. I figure out, okay, let's look at the four cells near it, how close it is to each one of them, make some sort of weighted average of their velocities. So this one is mostly near this cell. It's probably going to end up going mostly down. It's just a tiny bit of influence from the others. And then I'm going to multiply whatever that vector is by how much the time step is to figure out where I'm going to put the point next. Yes. So I'm going to take a linear interpolation, or weighting if you prefer. Weighted average means the same thing. Of the nearby velocities. Okay? Now, in practice, I should do this differently for x and y if I'm doing a staggered grid, because they're on different grids. But I do this for each of the velocities. That gives me a velocity, an interpolated velocity at this point. And then I multiply that, I do that velocity that I found, the velocity approximation I found here, times the change in time, equals the change in position. Okay, so I take that velocity vector that I interpolated to this point, multiply it by my time step, that tells me how much to move, I add it to where I am. Okay, and this way I can forward advect stuff through the fluid.
So you do this for x?
No, I would do this for each point. So yeah, let's see what this would look like on a staggered grid. Okay, so if I were on a staggered grid, okay, then, and I'm looking at this point right here. In x, that point wants to look at these velocities. And it's going to take a linear weight based on how close it is to those four points. So if this was, I don't know, if this was going a lot that way, and that was going a little bit this way, and that was going a little bit that way, and that was going quite a lot that way, I would take some weighted average of those, and I would decide, okay, my x component is something like that. And then I would do a similar thing with the neighboring y's. Then I fall inside that grid. And they would each have whatever their velocity was. Okay. In the y coordinate, and I would take some sort of weighted averages of those as well, and I would end up with what the y component was. I add those together, and I get what the velocity at this point is. Okay, and so that'd be the velocity at this point. I then multiply that by the time step to figure out how far I'm going, and plot my point. Yes?
Why do people use a staggered grid?
It turns out to be more stable in various ways. we have a more direct relationship between each component of velocity and the actual divergence. And so various pieces of the math just work out with a little bit less error, basically. There are other things. You don't have to use a stagger grid. You can use a self-centered grid. There's also what's called a half-stagger grid, where velocities are in the intersections of the, like, you'll have the velocities here and the stuff there. And there are various places where each of these has advantages. But the stagger grid is the most common that I have seen for this formulation of fluid motion. Yes?
Implementing a stagger grid, would you just have a bunch of arrays?
Yep, you have array for x, array for y, and array for the stuff. Yep. You could actually, it's somewhat tangential, in this, vorticity lives on the intersections. So the vorticity lives here. That is how much the fluid is spinning around. And so we actually, sometimes you will try to do some sort of vorticity-based system, and you'll have the vorticities here. And so then you can, anyway, this sometimes helps make things look a little bit more swirly if you keep tracks of vorticities. We'll talk about why that becomes an issue here in a moment. Questions about, yes?
For a large T, is this like really inaccurate?
Yeah, absolutely, yep. So but for a large T, you also don't get to see what the fluid's doing. So for graphics, we typically have small T's because we have frames. Sometimes it's even too big even then, so we'll make subframe versions, but typically we want small T's for animation. Yeah?
So that looks like infecting like for the random points, but what about
that is correct.
Points on the flow itself.
Yeah, so I have not talked, self-advection is a little bit more complicated than this, so we'll get to that in just a moment. But this is the basic principle of forward advection generally. We'll talk about backward advection, then we'll talk about how they apply to fluids, or to the velocities themselves. Yeah?
So in this staggered grid, you said the stuff is in the center of the cell?
Yeah.
So why do you need to calculate like at a random point that's not in the center of the cell?
Right, so sometimes so I could have particles just moving through the grid. Okay? And that way I could get a higher visual resolution than my simulation resolution. So if I have a relatively coarse grid, but a whole lot of little points, because I'm interpolating and so on, each of those points will have a slightly different motion, and I'll get a much a nicer looking simulation. Okay? But how would I do it if I wanted to do the center of the cell instead? Well, what I would do there is I would say, okay, the center of the cell, its x speed is the average of these two. Its y speed is the average of those two. That means it would advect to over here. Where does that fluid go? It goes into a linear weight of the four cells near where it went. And so if we want to move, if we just want to say, you know, this used to have seven stuff, and that had zero, and that had -3, and that had 2, what is it going to be next time? Forward advection would say for each of these cells, we say, okay, there was 7 stuff to distribute. It would have gone there. How much of it ends up in this cell, in this cell, in this cell, in this cell? And we create the new levels of stuff in each cell. Okay? This is the concept of forward advection. Question about this? All right. Backward advection is very similar to forward advection. The first several steps are the same. It's only the last step that's different. Okay. Let's actually finish up this little example before I go on to that. Okay. So if I were doing this and I decided it went over there, then of this original 7, I might decide that 4 stays here and 2 goes there and 2 goes there and 1 goes there, right? And so I would do this sort of computation. And one of the things you'll notice is that it's sort of spreading out. Because we're averaging, we're getting some spread of the stuff, okay? We're not going to be able to get away from that if we stick to this kind, if we stick to a finite, difference method, thank you. If we stick with Lagrangian, we're going to have this sort of what we call numerical averaging or numerical spread, numerical damping it's sometimes called. The fact we're using numbers causes it to look sort of diffuses amongst itself. But we could have said instead, I want to know how much stuff ends up here. We could have figured out, well, this area, whatever it's doing, I haven't drawn all the vectors. Let's just suppose its velocity, let's draw a different velocity so I can find out the answer. Let's suppose it was going in that direction. Backward advection says, I'm going to go backward by its current velocity and figure out how much stuff was near that place to figure out how much stuff should end up here. Okay? And so there's forward and backward. You can do them both. They will both allow me to put new amounts of stuff in a place. So I could say, okay, I have some amount of 2, some amount of 0, very little 7, a bunch of negative 3. Maybe I decide that comes out as being, I don't know, 0.2 or whatever it is should be there. And so my new value here will be 0.2 in that cell. This is the idea of backward advection. So forward advection, I figure out where it's going, I distribute it amongst those cells. Backward advection, I figure out where it came from, I look in those cells to find stuff. Yes?
So does that kind of preference like order that the cell is taking? So say there's 7 in the top left, but the first one has like a very high velocity, so it takes 5 of it, the next one.
It absolutely would matter if we did it all in one pass. In practice, all of the advections matter so much in the order of cells that we get around it by having 2 copies. Okay, so we have the copy that's showing us where stuff is coming from and flowing, and the copy that shows where it ends up. And we jump back and forth over the course of the simulation. Something called double buffering, because we have 2 buffers to swap back and forth between. Other questions? All right. If we think about this, there is stuff in our cells, and it's just a number. Guess what? That's what the velocity field was. The y velocity field, for example, here, it's just numbers in a grid. It happens to be a staggered grid in this case, but they're just numbers. And so if I want to know on the next time step what is the velocity in this cell, I find out the velocity at that point. I go wherever that went, and I add the velocities. Okay? And I can do it forward or backward, either find where the velocity came from or find where the velocity went. Okay, we have 2 of them for a reason. Let's talk about why. Forward advection. It has this nice sort of conserves. It conserves the numbers we're moving. Okay? And it does this because if there was 7 here, all 7 of those will go somewhere. We'll never put 8 somewhere, we'll never put 6 somewhere, we'll have 7. Yes?
Right now it's 9.
Oh, okay. Let's fix that. That doesn't make any sense, but at least it adds up. Let's make that 3, 1.5, 1.5. That's a little better. It's still not a linear combination, but anyway. Yeah. So if there's 7 to start with, it ends up being 7 still moved, okay? So it conserves the number of stuff moving. That is to say, if we're doing self-advection, what we are moving is momentum. So this will preserve the total momentum of the fluid, okay? But not energy. Energy is proportional to the square of velocity. And forward advection has the possibility of dramatically changing the energy. Okay? So if I happen to have a bunch of fluid that's all sort of converging, I'll end up averaging them all together and end up with a really big, really, really big speed, which will create energy. And so we can also lose energy, but energy only goes down to 0. It can get really big. And so in general, forward advection can cause us to end up having our fluid occasionally just like go crazy, right? It'll get in some situation where it's creating a whole lot of energy someplace that's moving a whole lot more energy over someplace else, and then it wiggles around because we're making it be divergence-free, and the whole thing explodes, okay? We can get around this. The smaller our time step is, the closer to conserving energy we get. But we have to get it quite some. So there's usually like some magic threshold for any given velocity field. If you take a step bigger than this, you're going to be in a problem. You take a step smaller than this, you're okay. But knowing what that number is not always easy, and usually it's smaller than we wanted to take. Okay. If we think about backward advection, okay, it does not conserve the material. Okay, it is possible that I had seven things here and all of the vectors around it weren't looking at it. And it just poof goes away. Right? So we can lose stuff. Okay? This can be lossy. But it never increases. Okay? So it never gets too much. This tends to make things, backward advection is stable in that sense. Okay, so I'm not going to get things get bigger and bigger and bigger and more concentrated. So I have some level of entropy in backwards advection that I don't necessarily have in forwards advection. So often, if we backwards advect our velocities, it may make the fluid sort of lose energy fast, as if it was thick and sluggish. But it'll still look like a liquid. If we do forward advection, it might instead look like, I don't know, like liquid that is randomly getting excited. And that is a strange thing to see. So backwards advection, first published, I think it was in 1995, people figured out, ooh, this is so much better. Yes, it's worse physically. We aren't preserving anything. But it is better for simulation because we are preserving some notion of entropy, some unilateral, never gaining energy kind of thing. There are a lot of these kinds of little things in fluids. A lot of little somebody says, but I wanted to preserve everything. Maybe we can do something else. And so then you could say, ooh, what if we measure that vorticity at each point and we advect vorticity? We'll forward advect vorticity and then we'll backwards figure out what the velocities would be and then we'll use that to advect the fluid. And you try all kinds of different combinations until you find one that works better for whatever it is you want to do. And there are papers published just about every year with a new combination of ways of doing things that works better than the ones we've had before. And we get better and better at doing these visual fluid simulations. If we were doing aerospace engineering to analyze how our plane wings work, any sort of loss would be bad, right? We won't want to lose or gain energy. These are bad things. That is not how physics works. Our airplane won't fly right, right? And so we have a whole different set of steps that we deal with. But here we're just concerned, does it look pretty? And if we can make it look more pretty, we're better off. Yes?
Does adding friction to forward advection help at all?
It can. So I can add a numerical damping effect. But I need to know how much of that to add, and if I'm doing that in addition to the forward advection, I've got both the numerical damping I always have because there's a grid, and more I've added reduce energy, and so it ends up making it a very viscous looking fluid. All right. Questions about these ideas? Okay. So this is the core of using a grid to do your simulations. You can tweak it around, you can add various effects. They will tend to lose energy automatically because you have averaging going on, and there are various tricks to try to bring it back in by handling vorticities or by measuring the energy before and the energy after and just multiplying to get the energy back up to what you wanted it to be. That can create weird effects too, but it looks okay, right? And there's lots of papers about how to do these different things. You can also use like image approaches where you just make everything more crisp. You see, if this is moving a little bit faster than that, make them a little bit more different. And that kind of effect can also make it sort of add some visual interest. And if all we're interested in is, ooh, it looks like a poof of smoke, then we're good. If we care about, oh, and Bernoulli's principle work, not as much. All right, so this is the basic idea of how we do fluids on grids. Thoughts, comments, questions? All right. Let's just talk briefly. I hope this isn't going to crash the recording. All right, I was showing part of a video earlier. We're going to pick it back up where I left off. So this is using something called implicit smooth particle hydrodynamics. This is a mesh-free approach. Now, this actually is about solids. And the basic, so they have an internal mesh, and we'll talk some more about that later. But we're going to start by saying, okay, we have these weird armadillo models, and they just splash. Okay, let's take a pause. What do we see? We see a whole lot of little spheres. Okay? And we see they're glooming up and they sort of stick to each other somehow. And then some of them don't. And there's a little bit of squishing and blooping around and they mix around. And this is the behavior we want. Now we could create most of this behavior on a grid, but we wouldn't have the little balls. The little balls give us extra weird power, okay? And so as it goes along, we can have it sploosh and wobble and so on. And then we can bring down this glass lid, and then we can turn one of them back into an armadillo. Okay? Because, you know, you've always wanted more armadillos in your ball pits. And you can turn them all back into armadillos if you really want to. Right? And there, this is a power that you don't have if you're just doing stuff across a grid. Right? Because you don't really have a separable notion of points, and are they connected to each other, and where, and are they separate. And so sometimes it's just really nice. There's cooler things you can do if you aren't using grids. And so various types of Eulerian and grid-free approaches can often give us extra abilities to do funky things that make for cool movies. And so we tend to use a fair amount of those. So my plan is to go and talk about sort of the basics of how that works. Before I do that, any questions about our grids? Yes.
So, would the basic like loop of this simulation be figure out where the velocities are going to be next step using the matrices, and then figure out where the stuff's going to be next step?
Yeah, that's a good thing. All right, we're going to say, how do you do one frame? Hey, what do I do for a frame? In general, what I'm going to do is I'm going to advec the velocity. I'm going to make the velocity divergence free. Okay, by finding a nearby divergence free field. In theory, that's all I have to do. If I also want to have something flowing through it, I could then also advec stuff. And I could theoretically do that before as opposed to after. But if I do it after, I have it slightly closer to the frame. It looks slightly more responsive if we're trying to do this real time. If we're not doing real time, it really doesn't matter. This is the basic set of steps. Often there is various like reinsert energy or make it goopy. By averaging or something like this, right? And it matters a little bit where these things go if you have them, but this is the basic step. You do that over and over again, and then presumably you draw. Yes?
Could you elaborate on how to draw briefly? How would you draw from this step?
Yeah. So it depends on what I am drawing. So this just gives me fluids moving around. What am I drawing? So if I am drawing, let's say, smoke, let's try 2D smoke. This is one of the easiest ones. I just change stuff into whiteness. Okay? That's the simplest one probably to do. You have some amount of smoke in there. You draw it. It's paler than other stuff. What if you had 3D smoke? Okay? Then you need some sort of volumetric rendering. Which we haven't talked a lot about. It basically involves figuring out how far you're going through each cell and making the light dimmer and dimmer the more you go, maybe occasionally bouncing around at random. Smoke's actually fairly complicated to do. But if I wanted to do, say, water, okay, let's say 3D water, what I would do is I would create what we call a level set, which is to say blobbies, okay? So I will look for, using marching cubes, as we talked about a little bit last time. So I would go over my grid. I would say there's enough water here and not enough water there. So there's going to be a boundary between these, and then tweak them around to find the set of points where the boundary between water and not water is at some particular level, and then draw that surface. Does this answer your question? Other questions? Yeah.
Can you go back to the slide with the backward advection?
Forward advection. This one?
No, backward, sorry.
Backward advection.
Yeah, so why would the 7 disappear?
So backwards advection, a value is only grabbed if some vector written backward would have included some of it. And so if these are big enough, right, or the time step is large enough, each of these is reaching past it and none of them are seeing it. Now, this is actually useful because it means really big velocities are unlikely to be preserved, right? They're going to reach back to some small velocity somewhere else. They're going to be damped. The velocities around them are smaller. You're just going to be averaging it with the ones around it. That's what part of why we end up with this stable effect. Other questions? All right. How do we do all of this without a grid? There's actually a long period of time where people weren't really sure about this. There is an approach where we say, okay, maybe we advect the points on the grid. This would be a meshy Eulerian approach, where we advect the location of the vertices of the mesh that defines the cells. This turns out not to work super well. There have been a few approaches about doing this. They almost always need some sort of re-meshing step, where they say, well, this cell got squished out really wide. That's ugly. Let's change that around. And then what happened to the fluid in between? Okay. So there are some approaches to this. They haven't worked as well as we might have hoped. However, there are also other approaches where we just say, there is no mesh. There are just a lot of balls flying around in space. Okay. We could work through this in more detail, but the basic idea, how do we decide where these balls go? We need to have incompressible, and we need to have self-advecting. The self-advecting part is pretty easy. You give the balls momentum, and you just move them. And you don't have any averaging to do, you could just move them. Okay? So the main trick here is, how do I make it incompressible? And so what we want to do is some amount of, there are too many balls here and not enough balls there, and they get pulled and pushed. So conceptually, what we want to be able to say is, we want to have some notion of pressure. We want to say we have sort of high pressure over here, and we have low pressure over here. And if we had some notion of pressure, we could then find the gradient of the pressure field. And we could say that means that we have this sort of force pushing from high to low. And then once we have a force pushing from high to low, we could try applying it to these particles to try to get some level of incompressibility. Most of the early versions of this didn't actually make incompressible. They just made short-term compressible. If it compresses, it will later decompress. And so you get sort of squishy fluids, which don't react like anything in the real world, but if you simulate enough time steps, they would work pretty well. We've actually recently learned some newer, like in the past 5 years, we've learned some pretty good approaches actually making these incompressible, which I'll hand wave away one of them here in a little bit. We actually may talk actually theoretically all of how that, we'll try, we'll see. So the basic idea here is, how do I find out what these pressures are? And the other thing that we don't have here, I didn't need to talk about it in the previous one, but if we have no drag, if we have no viscosity in the fluid, then it doesn't behave in a natural way. You'll tend to end up with these sort of permanent eddies that don't go anywhere, and it becomes an uninteresting fluid. So we also need some level of viscosity. Viscosity really just means my velocity becomes more like the velocities of the things near me. So I need to know what's near me, what's the average velocity near me, what's the average pressure near me, what's the gradient of the pressure field. The smooth particle hydrodynamics. Smooth particle hydrodynamics. The idea here is actually similar to the idea of blobbies. I create some sort of distribution function around each of the points. If I were to try to draw it, I'd be, you know, some sort of bell curve of what their region of influence is. Okay? I make it a finite support so that I can have droplets. Remember, if we back up a little bit to where we had droplets. Okay. We want to be able to have things stick together until they get far enough away and then just float like free droplets. That's a desirable behavior. So you have a finite region it goes over. We want to sort of go away smoothly so we don't get weird adjustments in behavior. So some sort of bell curve works pretty well. And we put that around each of the points. And then and we can do that both to say, well, how many of these things overlap? That's an estimate of pressure. If there's a whole bunch of bell curves in some area, I have high pressure. If there's only one or zero, I have very low pressure. And then I can also say, and each of these represents some particular velocity. And so at any given point in space, I can say, what are the velocities of the bell curves here? So I can make viscosity by saying I take mostly my velocity, but some of the velocities of the people around me. And so I can do that. And then I can also find pressure by a similar phenomena. And I can combine those to create, once I have a pressure field, I can then take the derivative of that using a gradient, fairly easy to do in linear algebra. And I can use this to figure out how things ought to move. Okay? And early on, this is all we did. We would try to make the rule about how we deal with pressure look like the Navier-Stokes equations. So if we took a whole lot of time steps, it would act truly incompressible. But at any reasonable time step, it would always end up being compressible. We'd always end up with this squish and pop. Okay? And so we have this approach. Sometimes we would also try to simulate, since we have particles, we could say, well, how does water actually work? Here's a question. Why does water have a top? Why is there a surface of water? Okay, but why doesn't it just like keep going? There's a lot more water than there is air. Why doesn't it just go up into the air? Why doesn't it evaporate?
The like polar attraction between the water molecules largely.
Yeah, so one of the big things we have is water likes water. It attracts itself. There's actually another really important thing. Liquids cannot exist in a vacuum. Liquids require air pressing on them. Okay? This is just a characteristic of liquids, all liquids. Liquids require pressure. Hence we have things in physics like the triple point, where we find that magical pressure-temperature combination where things can be liquid, solid, and gas all at once. Anyway, so you have to have pressure, and you have this attraction, and so we can actually model these phenomena. We could say, this particle wants to go to all of the ones that are close enough, it wants to go closer to them. We find the ones close enough using this same sort of smooth particle idea. And then we can actually model the boundary between water and air by having air particles. So we'll add this little skin of particles around the edge of the surface. And that will actually create surface tension. If they're trying to pull each other and there's air pushing against them that they aren't being pulled by, they'll be pulled more on the surface than other places. Okay? We can also do this manually by saying we divide the pole by the number of things it's being pulled by. There are various ways of trying to simulate the actual physics here. And this can create nice-looking droplets. And we can actually modulate how much surface tension there is, and so on. These are things that the grid elements find a lot harder to do. They can make things thick, but they have difficulty making droplets that want to hold together. Okay, and there are approaches to trying to turn this back into the grid, but these tend to work better on these mess-free approaches. We can add every new phenomenon we know of, we can add to the system, and make it look more like this. If we had almost none of these, if we just say two particles can't bump into each other, we end up with something that looks like sand, because that's how sand behaves, right? And as we add more phenomena on top of it, we can make it look like water or like honey or whatever it is we want to make it look like. And we'll talk some more about how honey works on Tuesday. So this is the basic principle. There's a lot more we could say, and there's a lot of different versions of smooth particle hydrodynamics. Far more versions of this that I know of than I know of the grid approaches. Because once you say we have particles and they interact by things near them, there's many, many different sets of things near them we could have. So there are approaches, for example, where they'll say, we have two kinds of particles, moving particles and vorticity particles. And vorticity particles spin things around, and moving particles move, and they have rules about how they interact with each other. And anyway, there's lots and lots of versions of what we can do with particles, because there's just more math available to us. About to try to explain how we get true incompressibility. Before I go there, questions about the general concepts that I've hand-waved at for smooth particle hydrodynamics. Oh, let me actually say one more thing about this video. Let's back up here to our weird rabbit. All right, so how does this weird rabbit work? We have a whole bunch of points. We have two sets of rules. We have behave like a liquid, and we have stay close to the ones that should be near you. So we sort of have a mesh of where they should all be relative to each other, and we have you can behave like a water, and we can decide the relative importance of those two. Okay? And so what happens here for this little piece of the animation is we say, okay, it was a bunny, we just turn off the stay teeth your neighbors. And now it goes like, in this case, like sand, because they turned off the water part too. And then that part there would say, no, turn them back on, go find your neighbors. And now it acts like this sort of bouncy thing. Okay? It acts sort of jello-y because it's got two forces. It's got the liquid force, and it's also got this springy force. Every particle is sort of being pulled to the ones it should be near by some sort of spring-like thing. And when it splats against the surface, the water takes over, but then it'll try to pull itself back. And so you'll actually see like particles in the middle will like start shooting across to find their neighbors as they're all trying to pull themselves back. And they'll be sort of like, I'm erupting inside out. So I'm deciding, ooh, it'll be easier to be facing the other direction, right? And so it has this sort of pulsing effect. So this actually only just came out, this paper was published just last year on this particular combination. There have been other approaches, and there's always like, how do I mix up all of the pieces well? And this one said, ooh, we should think about things about solids too. And so they have things about stress and strain and how all of those things apply. They have rules for how those apply in the particles that they mix in with the rest of what's going on. And so we can do lots of cool things with particles. Let's talk about how we get perfect incompressibility. I'm going to regret trying this. I'll try it anyway. All right. Let's go back to our Voronoi diagram. A Voronoi diagram, we mentioned last time, can be thought of as the dual of a Delaunay triangulation, or it can be thought of as all of the points that are closer to a point than to any other point. Okay? So that means we end up with these boundaries that are bisectors of points, and they intersect someplace, and that gives us our Voronoi cell. Right? And sometimes they don't bump into each other because other ones get in the way, and so I'm going to have whatever this cell is here is going to be the cell for that point. So that is the set of points closer to this point than to any other. Voronoi diagram. Now, what if this point was a lot bigger than the others? If that point was a lot bigger than the others, and I tried to do the same work, I tried to still find the things closer to one thing than another, then I would have different shaped boundaries. This would turn out to have this sort of hyperbolic shape to it. Yes?
Can you define what you mean by a larger point?
I mean, it has a radius.
Okay. Is it still a point then?
It's a circle. Okay. So we actually say, what are the points that are closer to the edge of this circle than the edge of that circle? This is an extension of the Voronoi idea. Okay? There are various formulations of this, but in general, when we have circles, we call them a power diagram. And by adjusting the size of the points, we can make the volume of each cell anything we want it to be. Okay? So you can find your diagram, your original Voronoi diagram, where everything's just a point. You can then say, oh no, this cell is small and that one's big. I want them to be the same size. You can adjust the powers until that is so. And how you do that, it turns out, is by solving a linear equation. There's linear equations all over in everything we do with fluids. So we solve a linear system of equations. We can find out what size they would need to be to make each cell the size we want it to be. And having found each cell the size we want it to be, we can then use that to make sure that we have complete incompressibility. Okay? So I can say I want each cell to be an incompressible cell, and the way I am doing that is by making sure that its volume is constant. So let's look at power particles fluids. I should have pre-prepped this one, but I didn't get here in time. No! Power particles, here we are. All right. This is quite a long video, and I did not spend time pre-doing it. Okay, that isn't really what I had in mind. All right. Okay, so the idea here is that we want to try to, they've got a lot of diagrams about things that do and don't work. Okay, so here's the idea. We have this idea of a power diagram that we're going to use to try to make this work. I'm already running out of speed here and it's going very slowly. Right, so we have this idea of cells, and if we convert them into something else, this is not the video I thought it was. This is for the paper I thought it was. We can make some cells bigger than others, and there's how do you solve this, okay? But then what we can do is we can, I went too far. Okay, come on, here we have some diagrams, okay? What we can do is we can say if we have all these points, we can compute how big each one cell needs to be to make sure they always have a constant constant volume. This is apparently just a slide deck. I thought this was going to be the animations. Sorry. All right, I'm not seeing the animations I want. This is probably it. Let's see. Yeah, this is the one I want. Part one, 3D examples, okay? And so the idea here is we want to have all kinds of splashy things where the color here represents the pressure, right? This represents how big does that point need to be. The white means I just make it a little dot. The blue means I make it a big ball because I'm pushing everything else away. And we can push the centers of these regions away by finding ourselves a bigger power cell, okay? And then as it wiggles around, we can watch what that happens and get all kinds of splashy behaviors and so on by having this perfect behavior of keeping everything the right shape. Okay? And so we can have all of the standard simulations of the dam breaking and going around things and watching how it splashes on top of itself. If you do a lot of these, you'll start to learn that we always show the same things. Okay? And we show the ones that are designed to be stressful for other situations where you'd normally find compression because there's areas of really high pressure. And then they do it with blobbies on top of it so you can see it more clearly and so on. Okay? And what happens if you twist it? Hooray! We can twist it around just like everything else. All right. All of these things are based on these ideas. Now, even this, like having a spinning thing in the grid, that's hard. You can do it, but you have to say, okay, what part of the grid are we pushing stuff out of and what direction is it going? Because we use these particle approaches, we can guarantee these behaviors. And if we, so what we do, let me bring the last little piece of this, okay? Let's suppose I end up with a bunch of points here and a bunch of points spaced out here. I may discover for this one to be the right size, its circle has to be really huge. And so it may end up actually having its cell over here. It may not even overlap. Because we may have big circles for each of these that push the cells far away. But we can solve for one that will have cells. And then we can treat the point not as being here, but as being at the centroid of its cell, wherever that happens to be. And so we can have the particles move around and recenter them, but keep their velocities, and we can have this very nice approach. So there's lots of different ways of doing this. From just we make these smoothing things, to we compute cells, or we had fixed grids. But in the end, we're always trying to preserve the same two things. We're always trying to preserve incompressibility and divergence-free. And in almost every case, we need to do something non-local. We have to do something non-local to truly get incompressibility, because it could have affected a distance. And so that usually means solving some sort of linear system, either by taking many tiny little steps in a compressible fluid that we're pretending is incompressible, or by having some sort of linear system that does it all at once. Thoughts, comments, questions? All right, now we have another day of this. What are we going to do on the next day? We're going to talk about elastoviscosity and a little bit about spring force diagrams. Anyway, we're going to talk about how we do weird stuff. Because so far I've just said, how do you make things incompressible? Well, that's just the baseline, right? That is just the thing you get done first before you do the cool things. And so we're going to talk about all the cool things we can add on top of this. I do want to say we have a couple minutes left. I want to say just a little bit about projects. All right, let's just talk a little bit about your final project. I realize that we have WebGL due in a little bit here yet, but we have courses are ending in not that long, okay? And projects due then, because that's what I'm told I'm supposed to do. So if you want to do a project that isn't the main project, I would like to have a chance to look at it and tell you, you bit off more than you can chew, just do this half, it will be fine, before then. So if you're thinking, there is something that seems cool I would like to do, I would like to add X, Y, Z new features to something we already did, or I've always wanted to make a, you know, a cool 3D first-person shooter video game, or Fluid sound cool, I wonder if I can make it work. I would like to have just sort of a general, I have an idea, I'm thinking down this line, preferably pretty soon. And then I'll probably ask for before this class, I want us to be more or less firmed up what's going on. That will probably look like you will say, I want to do something about X. And then I will say, okay, but only do this half of it, and go write down some ideas about specifics. And you'll say, here's my ideas, and say, those are too hard, here's some other ones. So it'll probably be two rounds before we settle on the project description. So if you're thinking about that, you should. I know you've also got other things to work about, but you should be thinking about that fairly soon, so we can start having those conversations. Questions about project? I should comment, I said if for a reason. There is a stock project you can do instead. It's here, hooray. And it mostly deals with stuff that we've already talked about colors many months ago, and then just reading and writing pictures and doing a little bit of matrices. We probably won't spend much time in class on that, although we may spend a little after the project comes live. Anything else in our last minute? And I will see you all on Tuesday. Thank you.